then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 20th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, this week it happened. This week I received an email of a kind that I've always known that I would receive someday. I got a message from a man who is not exactly a party supporter, but he's one of these guys who kind of hangs around the periphery of the party as a hobby. We get a lot of those. And to be fair, every time I drop a few heavy hints about how it's time he paid to play, he'll slip a 10 or 20 into an envelope. He comes up with enough every year for a Northwest Observer subscription, but not enough to make member status and so get the orglet. And yes, I've finally fallen into using the term member because it's what you understand, never mind that it's not accurate. That's one of the many things that I'm having difficulty conveying any sense of complexity or nuance on. Americans don't do complex, and they damn sure don't do nuance. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, this guy. He sends me an email basically to the effect of, Harold, you was wrong. We ain't gonna have to move nowhere after all because we're gonna elect Donald Trump president, and he's gonna build a wall and throw the beaners out and repeal Obamacare and do something about the niggers. No one knows exactly what because he ain't saying nothing yet about the niggers, but he'll do something and then everything will be all right, and we can just plop back on the sofa and pop the top on a brewski and see what's on the tube tonight. Meh. No, seriously, this man, who so far as I can observe is not stupid, and who from some of his other emails seems to have at least some political and racial education and knowledge and awareness, seriously believes, or rather I think desperately wants to believe, that somehow electing one man as president will solve all this country's problems. Of course, that is essentially what all of us have been taught our whole lives by the media and by the Judaic culture we live in. There are a lot out there like this man who emailed me, including many in our own ranks, who are deeply and desperately longing, pining for that man on a white horse who will come galloping along, flourishing his saber aloft, and save us all without our having to exert any effort or incur any risk at all. I know, I keep saying this almost every week, but you folks need to internalize this. The passionate and frantic craving the white man has for someone else to do it, and the wild adoration he will manifest for any politician or public figure from the world of celebrity with a blow-dried bouffant hairdo whose face shows up on TV and promises that he will be the one. He will save us, and all he needs is just a few votes and maybe a few bucks, and then we can all get back to Dancing with the Stars and taking the wife and kids to Six Flags for the weekend. White Americans seem to have this almost pathetic faith that everything that's happened in this country over the past 4 or 5 decades or so is just some kind of aberration, a mistake, some kind of blip on the radar screen of history, that the real world we remember from our childhood is still out there somewhere, hiding or whatever, and that at some point, somehow, through some magic process we don't understand, one day everything's just going to come right, all on its own. Absent National Socialism or Northwest Nationalism or Christian Identity or some other strong white racial belief system, it is this faith in a sudden miraculous return to the past that has been keeping a lot of white people going. Now, central to this narrative of false hope is the figure of the Magic President. In our vague minds, he is a tall and handsome white man in a nice suit who will come out of the world of celebrity, so we will know him, know his face, and be comfortable with him. He will say out loud in front of the television camera so everyone can hear him that which we all have been longing and waiting for someone to say out loud. He will show courage, i.e. he will not allow the left-wing liberal filth or the bubble-lipped, nappy-headed niggers to shout him down and threaten him, which for a white man these days is courage indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Donald Trump. I've been expecting someone like Trump for years. I've been waiting for someone from the world of celebrity with ego and ambition to realize that the nation is psychologically waiting for a, pardon the expression, white Martin Luther King, and who decides he wants to be that figure, or at least the white Al Sharpton. Now it's happening. That narrative I just described about the magic president, our own racial Santa Claus, is how we've been socially and psychologically engineered. We all believe in our subconscious, no matter what our conscious minds may understand, that the position of president is kind of like a king or a pope, and if we could just elect a quote-unquote good man to the White House, he has the power to wave a magic wand and fix everything that's wrong, kind of like what some of you expect out of me when it comes to making a full-blown revolutionary party spring out of the earth. Now, that's not going to happen. It's not how the real world works. I'm tempted to say that I'm astounded and I actually have to be explaining all this, but I'm not really, because I understand how deeply the mythical figure of the magic president is ingrained into the white psyche. So let's take a look at what's going on in the real world here, shall we? Right now, I will not speculate on Donald Trump's motives. In fact, in deference to those of you who like him, and I kind of like him myself, I think he's funny. So I'll go him one better than that. I will assume for the sake of argument that he is sincere and that he is not part of some prearranged conspiracy to go third party and throw the election to Hillary Clinton. Now, that doesn't mean that he won't do just that. When the Republican Party machine, the RINOs, or Country Club Republicans as they're known, make their muscle felt and jew him out of the nomination, as they most certainly will. You guys out there who are becoming Trumpistas or Trumpledores or whatever need to understand that fact. Now, that's one thing where, yes, Donald Trump is presented accurately in the media. He is a genuine outsider, not part of the Republican establishment or the power structure, and he simply will not be allowed to receive the nomination. The nominee is going to be Jeb Bush, or possibly, just maybe, Scott Walker, if some insurmountable problem develops with Jeb or he just plain falls too flat on his face due to his own nonentity. If nothing else, the Republican establishment will simply do to Trump what they did to Ron Paul in 2008 and steal all his votes in the Iowa caucuses and in the New Hampshire primary. Yes, yes, I hear you shouting that Donald Trump isn't a spineless mollusk like Ron Paul, and Trump would actually fight it in courts of law and in the court of public opinion. Yeah, he'll fight it, and they'll kick him right into a courtroom with some Bush-appointed judge who will work with the GOP defendant's attorneys in a choreographed show that will tie the whole lawsuit in knots until after November 2016. Just because Trump will fight the probably inevitable vote fraud in Iowa and New Hampshire doesn't mean he will win or be allowed the nomination. So, what will the Donald do? He will bellow in rage at what is being done to him by the Country Club GOP power structure in Iowa and New Hampshire. He will get millions of white American voters enraged and antagonized at what's being done to him by the Republican Party, and at some point, probably after they rob him of Super Tuesday as well through diddling the voting machines, Donald Trump will go third party and throw the election to Hillary Clinton, who in turn will probably go insane or senile at some point in her presidency and have to be constitutionally replaced by whoever her vice president is on the grounds that she's gaga. And so that's something we need to watch. Remember that song I played a few weeks ago, Sarah Jean, the Nut House Queen? That may be our first woman president. Now, I repeat, Trump will go third party. Possibly not because it was meant to happen all along, or it was all planned in advance in those phone conversations with Bill Clinton. Now remember, we're giving Trump the benefit of the doubt here. He will go third party because he is a spoiled billionaire buffoon who's not used to being thwarted or denied his way in anything. And when the GOP shakers and movers in the back room jew him out of what he thinks is his due, he will throw a tantrum. As always, with the American political process, any reference to what the voters actually want will be conspicuous by its absence. Right, moving right along here, I have been conducting another email conversation for a few weeks now with a lady in another state. We've gotten into a kind of philosophical discussion on life in general, and we're plumbing the depths of that incredibly complex and fascinating topic, why are white people the way they are? What in God's name has turned us from the greatest conquerors, explorers, discoverers, inventors, and empire builders in history into the squamous, filthy-furred mass of cowardly, yellow-backed weasels that we are today? After going through a bout of true goo-boo in her life, not movement goo-boo, but just plain old-fashioned American bullshit, like I think I myself went through back in January, this lady asked me, Harold, what is wrong with our minds? Why is there so much needless and pointless drama in white life? Why are we so fucked up? Now, like I've said, this is a topic of endless speculation and wide-sweeping conjecture and has been for generations ever since I've been involved in this thing of ours. Why in God's name do we as a people behave in ways which are so clearly and obviously counter to our own best interest? What in the name of great Caesar's ghost is wrong with us? What's wrong with our minds? So let me take yet another stab at this. Americans as a whole, and white women in particular, are brought up by the television and the Hollywood media and lately the internet into a certain narrative. Key to that narrative is the idea that us white Americans are indeed privileged in a way, although that, of course, is not how it's put. We are brought up by television and the electronic narrative in other forms to believe that if we conform, if we are good liberals, if we spend our youth believing and accepting what we are told by them as is so much smarter and better than us on subjects like race and global warming and the Holocaust and a dozen other issues, and above all, if we always vote Democrat, then us white boys will be rewarded with a wonderful, fantastic, exciting life, a kind of extended adolescence that lasts into our early 40s or so, in which we snowboard down the slopes at Aspen or spend our days on the beach in Maui searching for the perfect wave, or we ride around with a hot chick in a van solving mysteries or some other bird-brained Hollywood fantasy. Of course, out here in the real world, it doesn't happen. We're taught from childhood by the media that not only is this fantasy world possible, but after a while we come to believe that it is our right. And then when it doesn't pan out in real life, when we find ourselves 31 years old with our useless degrees in liberal arts and political science and $75,000 in student loan debt, living in our parents' basement delivering pizzas and unable ever to begin our lives, when white women won't even look at us without a luxury car, flawlessly capped white teeth, and other indications of wealth, without a clear display of both money and left-wing liberal ideological conformity that they understand correctly might provide security in this insane world, when it becomes apparent that some invisible evil is keeping this wonderful, fantastic life we've been promised away from us, then white boys get upset and angry and very weird. And then strange and self-destructive things like Dylann Roof happen. A part of the perversions of mind that this narrative imposes is a need for drama in one's life as seen on the electronic screens, both television and cinematic. A belief that if one is not living in a constant melodrama of angst and intrigue and pointless little feuds with other people over things that don't matter, then one is not quote-unquote living. We see this a lot in the workplace where there are salary checks and other small amounts of money at stake. Remember, money is the prime motivator for white Americans and after that personal ego. Now, that's why we're such weasels. We are motivated by moral offal. If you are not living in a soap opera and your everyday existence wouldn't make a good TV script, then, quote-unquote, life is passing you by. So many white people deliberately create drama in their lives in order to feel like they're living. Simply settling back and just living is not only a luxury that the establishment allows us less and less, it's something we don't seem to want. We are told by the electronic screen that if we're not living in constant turmoil and petty teapot tempests all the time, then we're not really living. Just settling down and enjoying things as they come and not sweating the small stuff, why, that means life is passing you by. There must be sound and fury, Sturm und Drang. Now, this is especially common in the dwindling number of sexual relationships between white men and women. I've noticed that throughout white society, it seems almost impossible for couples to just lay back and go with the flow and be easy with one another. Everything has to be a big production of almost operatic proportions, with both man and woman singing arias, because that's the way it is on the moving electronic screen. Look, this is a subject that can stand endless exposition, but if you guys are having a problem with drama and goo-boo, try to find some way to remove the moving electronic screen from your life and remove the official narrative about how, in exchange for pulling that lever marked D, everyone has the right to stay 17 years old until they're 35 and live like they're the Hardy Boys or the Witches and Charmed or like characters in a Porky's movie. No, dudes, that's not real life. You need to get it out of your minds. Try getting a friend to go upside your head a couple of times with a baseball bat and see if that works. Right, I have a guy who seems to spend most of his time every week digging up weird stuff on the internet for me to play on the show, and either he forgets to label those audio clips with who performed the song, or in my encroaching senility, I keep forgetting to label them. This is called Party in the CIA, and it's by somebody or other.
Recently, with a plain and simple dream, wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansion suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on, got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Cramming the phones like, yeah. Shredding the files like, yeah. I memorized all the enemy's spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA. I've done a couple of crazy things that have almost gotten me dismissed. Like terminate some head of state who wasn't even on my list. Burn that microfilm, buddy, will you? I tell you why, but then I'd have to kill you. You need a quickie confession? We'll start a waterboarding session. No hurry on this South American dictator. I'll assassinate him later. That's when he walked right in my laser sights. And my silencer was on. My silencer was on, and another target's gone. Yeah, we got our flag up all over the world, from Kazakhstan to Bombay. Paying the bribes like, yeah. Plugging the leaks like, yeah. Interrogating the scum of the earth. We'll break them by the break of day. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. Need a country to stabilize, stabilize. Look no further, we're your guy, we're your guy. We've got snazzy suits and ties, suits and ties. And a better dental plan than the FBI's. Better put your hands up and get in the van, or else you'll get blown away. Staging a coup like this, brainwashing moles like this. We only torture the folks we don't like. You're probably gonna be okay. You're gonna be okay. Yeah, yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA.
Comrades, and welcome to my fourth edition of Arthur Kemp's March of the Titans. Now, by the fall of Rome, very few original Roman families were left. In 570, the Lombards would drive the Latins to the foot of Italy. Now, in the mid-800s, the Moors attacked Sicily, and eventually Louis II was called in by the Pope. In 1176, up in the north, the Lombard League defeated Frederick I. As a result of this, Venice became much more powerful and ends up having colonies in the Mideast. Now, at a trading post in Crimea, the plague ended up being used in a very gruesome way as a form of germ warfare, and as a result, the plague first spread to Italy. Now, between 1347 and 1400, there were 25 million deaths throughout Europe, so that's really extremely staggering to contemplate. Now, in 1796, Italy was invaded by Napoleon, and Rome became part of the French Empire. Now, after Napoleon, some areas of Italy were independent, and others were parts of Austria. Now, starting around 1820 and accelerating to 1848, there becomes a very strong desire to unify Italy, and there are four Italians in particular that are extremely influential. One of them is the organizer of a paramilitary organization, and one of them is the King of Sardinia. Eventually, in the 1900s, there is a very strong communist influence that comes about in Italy. And Victor Emmanuel, one of these four very influential Italians, appoints Mussolini to try and handle this growth of communism. Now, this is a good time to define the difference between fascism and national socialism. Fascism is an organization of the state along authoritarian lines, whereas National Socialism is a biological worldview. Now, as a result, a National Socialist state could have an authoritarian government. However, that is the form of government that may be in place and not the worldview itself. Mussolini did help Italy through the Depression and did reorganize the government and the economy. Now, one of the things that Mussolini did, was to create an independent Vatican. And that is something that is still in place today. Let's shift our focus a bit to Italy and the trains running on time and so forth to the issue of Germany. Now, Germany came under Christianity when Widukind was baptized in 785. When Charlemagne came along, Germany was essentially the province of East Francia. But Germans were really left to their own devices, and traditionally they had an elected kingship. Now, one of these important early kings was Otto I. And he was elected in 936, and he defeated the Magyars at Lechtfeld in 955 and won Magdeburg. In 962, he went to Italy to fight a usurper by the name of Berengar at the Pope's request. Now, Otto was victorious in this, and he ends up crowning himself Holy Roman Emperor. This implication of Holy Roman Emperor, this brings up the issue of kings versus popes. Kings would either be led by popes or they would dispose popes. Now, in 1338, papal authority over kings was seriously challenged and abandoned at Reims. And in 1418, Albert of Austria was elected Emperor of Germany. In 1517 and 1520, you have Martin Luther being active and talking about the Christian conscience. Frederick the Wise ends up deciding to help him. So Martin Luther is able to translate the Bible. Now, this helped to standardize the German language, and in 1555, you have the Peace of Augsburg, and then in 1618, you have the 30 Years' War that reaffirmed the various states' right to choose either Protestant or Catholic. In 1683, German and Polish armies pushed back the Turks from Vienna, which always seems to be quite the prize. During a series of wars relating to secession, many Germans end up immigrating to the New World. And in 1815, the Holy Roman Empire is dissolved and is replaced by the German Federation. Now, at this point, you get Bismarck and this invention of realpolitik. You have some new territories acquired for Prussia. Bismarck was Protestant, and he wanted independence from popes, and he also disliked socialism. This was a view termed Kulturkampf. By 1907, you essentially had two camps in Europe. You had the Triple Alliance with Germany, Austria, and Italy, and you had the Triple Entente with Russia, France, and Britain. Now, after World War I, like Italy, Germany sees a strong growth in hardline communism, and the Weimar was actually created by socialists who were moderate by comparison. Now, even after World War II and up until 1995, you have two radical communist groups that persisted in Germany. One was called Bader-Meinhof Group, and one was called the Revolutionary Cell, which was even more radical. Now, I would like to spend a bit of time talking about Russia. Russia is significant for three reasons. It was the original source of the Indo-Europeans. It bore the brunt of Asia, and it was also seized by communists. Rurik the Rodson is called to help Russia fight the Khazars. He's a Viking. In 988, Russia was declared Christian. In 1017, Yaroslav defeats the Pasenek Turks. Although when it came to the Mongols in 1240, although they were stopped at Kalka, Russia had to pay tribute to the Golden Horde until 1480. Ivan III was the first to see Mongols as weakened. He stops paying tribute, and Russia ends up expanding quite a bit. Now, in 1543 to 1649, you have some very harsh laws enacted regarding serfdom. Now, in 1670, you have your first peasant rebellion. And in the 1700s, Peter the Great wants to work for some westernization. Now, after Peter the Great, you have Catherine the Great, and she considers very seriously some reforms for the serfs, but ends up being talked out of it due to the goings-on of the French Revolution and the fact that nobles were very scared of reform. Now, eventually, Alexander II does emancipate the serfs in 1861, but ends up being assassinated in 1881. The situation ends up escalating, and actually there's a very sad event during the reign of Nicholas II when a petition was taken to the palace and a group of peaceful protesters ended up being shot. Now, it's true that many Jews were found among the groups that were influential in the Russian Revolution, but it's also true that many European royals, including the Romanovs, were unable to successfully market themselves to the peasantry, unlike the English nobles who were able to do that. So, as a result, the Romanovs were overthrown. I thank you very much for listening, because I really think this edition is a very important one as far as explaining how Europe got to be the way it is today. So, have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
gonna do what they say can't be done. Well, we've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. My best time just like a bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind the brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from the Badlands of North Dakota on I-94. I'm on my way from the homeland to Virginia with a load of seafood delivered over there later this week. Anyway, I wanted to go and drop two phrases on you that you all really should keep at the forefront of your mind. One is, united we stand and divided we fall. I guess that came from a Greek philosopher way back when. And the other one is, no matter how strong the chain is, it's only as strong as its weakest link. So that's why we all need to band together like a rope or a cable where multiple strands give added strength. I don't care how big and bad you think you are, the primates run in packs. And when, obviously, like in Ferguson last year and Baltimore earlier this year, they will overwhelm just about anything given enough numbers. And when the police go and pull back because they're too weak on numbers, they just overwhelm and run rampant. And no matter what the situation will be, whether it's a natural disaster, a failure of the power grid, their EBT cards getting shut down. Of course, the grand and glorious primate in the White House would never let that happen, but I think it would be kind of humorous if it did, and they ran rampant. And once they expend the resources in their area, guess what? They're going to expand outward, and they come after the prepared white folk because we don't have our heads up our collective asses. And we have some reserves stocked away, unlike them, that just go and live from day to day and food stamp to food stamp. So, like I was saying, your best strength is in numbers. So, why not get to the homeland where we can get our numbers up and repel the primates and keep them from running rampshod over us? Because you've seen it in the past. I mean, when I was a little youngin' and stuff, we had that, and Detroit went and blew up, and they basically had the city shut down, and they just basically tore Detroit apart. And so, if you want to be part of that, wherever you happen to live at, great. I'm already up here in the homeland. We're waiting on you to show up. So, what's your holdup? My brother and his wife, they're not involved in the movement at all, at least not yet anyway. I haven't approached them on it. They're in the process of moving up here from flyover country over there in between the Missouri and the Mississippi River. They're waiting for their house to sell, and they're already had put an offer on a house up here in the Pugetopolis area. They've already moved their sailboat up here, and their other stuff is on the way, so... Anyway, hey, the movement's happening slowly but surely. They may not know it, but they're helping to whiten the area up here. So, what's your holdup? You really need to get up here and help with the program, because Mr. Covington's not going to be around forever. And I'm not far behind him, but yeah, we could use the help. So, get your act together. Pack up your assets, get your ducks in a row, and we'll see you up here in the homeland shortly. All right, comrades, this is the trucker signing off from another segment out here on the road.
Westbound, just watch your bandit run. unemployment's rising. It's ticked up once again. It stands at 9.8%, and soon it will be 10. And we're in Obama's prison. We're underneath his curse. And he ain't doing nothing but making things far worse. Jobs are disappearing. Obama, he don't mind. He'd rather ruin health care and leave us in a bind. Yes, we're in Obama's prison, where socialism rules. And the government is run by a bunch of liberal fools.
Now, wait a minute, Johnny. That's not fair. I, Barack Obama, understand the problems with our economy.
Yeah, you should. You're responsible for most of them.
Johnny, I don't know what you're talking about. My policies, like cap and trade, will get American industry moving.
Yeah, to other countries.
What about my stimulus bill?
Hey, Barack, stimulate this. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, never trust a Marxist. Now we've elected one, and I knew we had it coming. I know we can't be free. When the Democrats are wrecking our economy. My name is Sue. How do you do?
If I were recommending, as I do on occasion, that a young man pick a career path, one of the ones that I would suggest nowadays would be robotics, or something that would involve repairing or working with robot-type systems. It's going to be really strange, because once robotics becomes completely effective, in essence, the black man and the brown man will be obsolete. We won't need them anymore for servants, because robots will be doing it. Of course, this presumes that some remnant of the white race will still be alive to take advantage of this, but what do we do then when white people, if necessary, maybe could go off and live on a space station called Elysium on our own? I don't know how many of you saw that movie. It's really weird. We've got most of the world descending once more into almost primordial soup and savagery throughout the third world, but in the Western world, we do have these enclaves of very superior and advanced technology that are doing these fantastic things. They're talking about immortality and all that, but this is clearly only going to benefit a tiny minority. And at some point, as the Reds say, the contradictions between this system are just going to get too glaring, and something's going to have to give.
I think the big problem with this is maintaining control of the machines. When artificial intelligence exceeds human intelligence and it has access to more information than any one person could possibly stuff in his head, then that's a real control issue.
I'm sure we all saw one or more of the Terminator movies, and at that time it was pure science fiction that the machines could one day rise up and take over and try to exterminate humanity. Now I'm not so sure.
Well, now several very well-known, respected people, Nobel Prize winners, world-famous physicists. What's the name of that fellow in the wheelchair?
Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking, yeah. He's one of the ones who's sounding an alarm that artificial intelligence is a huge threat to the human race.
Just to go back to robots quickly, I read somewhere somebody said, Mexicans will do until we get better robots. But I have an anecdote. This is 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I was involved in an environmental fit-out in a warehouse for a drug company. It was all run by robots, and this is a long time ago. And this whole facility, the building was 100 feet high, 250 feet long, I forgot how wide. I watched these things operate. And they had this storage facility where somebody punched into a computer the raw material they wanted, and this robotic train would run down an alley, go up, pick out some material, bring it back, and set it on top of this little robot. And there was about 15 of them running around the floor, and they talked to one another so they don't run into one another. And the whole operation was run by either 6 or 8 people. That's the maintenance, too.
The first one I ever saw was in the late 80s in a place called Northern Telecom. I was working there. It was in the Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. And they had a mail robot. Instead of the mail boy or girl, you know, pushing the cart with the mail or inter-office communications all up and down the corridors, they had a robot. actually, I think they had more than one, that did the same thing. At some point, I think a human clerk actually sorted the mail and put it in the correct slots for collection. It was like a sort of a rolling cart, a rolling tool chest that mechanics have, except it had funny little slots and thingamajiggers in it. And I never actually saw it in action because I was working the night shift there, but I did see it going up and down the halls a couple of times. They had like a little track going down the center of the corridor under the carpet that guided it, and it could go just up and down through the cubicles. It could go into the elevator and go up to the second or third floor and come back down again. And at night, when it had finished its run, it just went in and went into its little cradle or whatever in the storage room downstairs and turned itself off, hooked itself up to its charger, and it's really weird.
Yeah, what about robotic war robots that are programmed to make their own decisions so they don't require a human to say, yes, launch your weapon, kill that human. Mm-hmm. It decides on its own.
That's supposedly being worked on by the military, and I can understand why the military would do that, because basically the quality of the American soldier has gone down so bad. Not just you know, the fact that they're nigger and Mexican gangbangers, but the white soldiers basically don't have the nerve for it anymore. They're all coming back with all this post-traumatic stress, and, oh, it was horrible, and they're using that as an excuse to live off the government for the rest of their lives. I suppose it's time for a Grandpa Simpson story. This will be a brief one. Some of you may remember who Cesar Chavez was. He was the head of the Farm Workers Union back in California in the 60s and 70s. A big lefty hero and everything. One of the biggest strikes that he ever led was in the late 60s. And somebody, and I think it was a company, one of these agribusiness companies that was actually growing fruit of some kind, apples, pears, something that grew on trees, was experimenting with training monkeys to actually pick the fruit, and instead of eating it or throwing it at each other, they were being trained to actually put it in bags and put it in bushel baskets, and apparently certain types of monkeys are trainable to a limited extent, and it was beginning to work, and there was at one stage a possibility that a good part of the Mexican labor force in California was going to be replaced by monkeys. And Chavez led all of his people out on just total, utter strike. They weren't even worried about wages or anything, just one demand. That whole program was to end, period, end of story, and they eventually got their way. But apparently it is possible not just to use machines, but you can also train animals to do some of the things that Mexicans and niggers do. So, yeah.
Well, I have a story that parallels that one very well. In 1972, University of California at Davis, which has a large agricultural school and also a mechanical engineering school, was the chosen institution for this program to mechanize agriculture to a high degree, in order to eliminate completely stoop labor, the sort of thing that Mexicans are hired to do. And it was shut down from high above in the government, and translated into English, that means the federal government, which probably means the White House. That was 1972, and all the people involved believed that what they were trying to accomplish was possible in 1972. Now look at 2015. If it was possible in 1972, it's a slam dunk in 2015. So that was killed. The fix was in. The Mexicans were going to be hired instead of clean, cheap, robotic, automated agricultural machinery.
Not to mention the fact that robots don't transmit salmonella and E. coli and various filthy diseases.
Yeah, that's what I meant when I said clean.
Yeah, all right.
quite a few years ago, I took a course, and I had to do a little report or a paper. And it was on artificial intelligence, and not that that's my forte, but I got into it, did some studying, some reading, just tangent to what we're talking about. I was amazed how the human mind and how we go about our business is very much like how a computer operates. And I think the conclusion I came to at the time, which was back in the early 90s, was that computers weren't fast enough and didn't have enough storage enough to formulate the decision the way a human does, because the human brain looks in so many areas, processes so much information so fast that a computer couldn't keep up. But now, some years have gone by, and I think it's highly possible, with the exception of one little thing, and I think it's part of the human brain that can't be addressed as this computer. But all your decisions are based on a set of rules and then associations, and your mind does work just like a computer. It has a hard drive with the storage, all your memory, and then the operating system, just how you approach things in life and make decisions on them. So it's highly possible that in the future, you know, it's going to be man against machine. the robots will be able to think and challenge humans.
Was that Isaac Asimov? He was very big into robots.
Could be Asimov, yeah.
Yeah. So, and it was the fellow who wrote With Folded Hands, which was a dystopian future about robots keeping us totally safe and eliminating all avoidable risk, which, of course, was a horrible world to live in.
Which leads us to 2001, A Space Odyssey, and HAL, when HAL took over. He had his own agenda.
Actually, if you read the book, I'll explain why he did that. He had, for the first time, a security program which prevented him from telling the truth. He was to keep the true purpose of the mission secret until just before they reached, what was it, Jupiter? And this created this sort of tension or stress, and there was another HAL 9000 on the Earth that monitored everything he did. So that HAL 9000 on the Earth was like his conscience, and he was reaching the point where he had to admit that he had lied, which was a horrible thing. He was designed from the get-go to accurately represent reality. And so, as the moment approached when he had to reveal that he was lying, the first thing he did was fake an antenna malfunction, break contact with his conscience on Earth, and then start killing off the astronauts.
I feel that racial consciousness is programmed into us genetically, and I think what happens to a lot of white people, you know, like the program gets corrupted. It's corrupted by the Jewish propaganda, perverting our sense of honesty, bringing about shame, and this altruism that's been hyped so it's totally ridiculous anymore. You know, you can't watch out for everybody.
Well, the white man is the only race on the face of the earth that is even capable of feeling altruism. Just like the white man is the only race on the face of the earth that seems to care anything at all about the environment. You don't get all this Greenpeace and all this eco stuff in China or Japan or Africa, certainly not.
Yeah, it isn't even worth mentioning them.
Do you see what's going on in Sweden? They've gone completely berserk. You know, I love Swedish extraction myself, partly, and what they're doing over there is totally insane.
Apparently, Jean Raspail's novel, The Camp of the Saints, is coming true. Apparently, there is some kind of wave of consciousness or whatever going through the Third World, and the Third World is literally trying to storm Europe. They finally, like 2 days ago, agreed to put up things like some razor wire and whatnot in the Channel Tunnel. But from what I gather, they literally have thousands of these WOGs charging the entrance of the tunnel to try and get through to Britain. And I presume they've had to shut down the tunnel for legitimate traffic. And I've been following it that close because, I mean, hell, there's just so much disaster I can put up with. But apparently it is getting to the point where it is just literally insane. And no one who lives in Europe can understand why the devil their governments aren't doing something to stop this and get these useless people out of there. Once more, it gets back to this total, complete lack of accountability, not just Obama in this country, but all throughout the Western world. These so-called liberal democratic governments have discovered that they can do anything they want, and lacking a, shall we say, direct response or the will to give them a direct and firm response to their misbehavior, they just do it. And it's becoming very difficult to avoid the impression that somebody has decided that it is finally time for Europe to become non-white. And they're just literally going to push what remains of the white Europeans just out of their countries, and it's just deranged.
Well, it's not somebody, it's the Jews.
Yeah. Well, George Soros and his ilk.
Yeah, the destroyers, they tear things down. They've been doing it for centuries.
Absolutely.
On our altruistic feelings, we let them in. They ride on the way up and make money, and then they ride on the way down and they make more money. And then when they're done with us, they move on to somebody else.
Well, there's not going to be anybody else to move on to. In a way, if the white man does disappear from the face of the earth, I really want to see how the Chinese are going to deal with all this. I think I know, and I think it's going to make Genghis Khan look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. I honestly don't think that the Asians, the yellow Asians, the proper Asians, are going to put up with this crap. Because it's this compassion, this altruism, this empathy is simply not in their genetic makeup. Maybe Confucius was right, and it is written in the stars that all people will eventually be Chinese. And if so, it will be because they lack the basic empathy and altruism and compassion that somehow or other the white man seems to have been lumbered with. I really don't think the Asians are going to put up with it. They're either going to put those niggers to work or they're going to kill them off.
Where's General Ripper when you really need him, huh?
Yeah. Okay, last week at about this time, we were talking about conspiracy theory, and so I played Blondie's One Way or Another with the chorus of Gonna Getcha, Getcha, Getcha. Since we've been talking about conspiracy theory, I thought that pretty much everybody would get that, but apparently not. I suppose it was a little bit esoteric, a little bit complex and nuanced, and like I was saying earlier, Americans don't do complexity and subtlety and nuance. This week, I was going to break at this juncture in the audio with Three Dog Night's Easy to Be Hard, but come to think of it, you probably wouldn't get that one either. So, how about some bagpipes? You guys get bagpipes, don't you?
I think you're right. I don't think they put up with the blacks. I don't know about the Jews, though. I've been reading a couple little blurbs over the years that they're already entrenched in China. Not that they control it, but they become an integral part of Chinese ventures. They steal the technology from us and they give it to them.
Sell the manufacturing techniques.
So I don't know. If the Chinese do take over, I sure hope they reach a point where they can just throw them out and get rid of them.
Yeah, well, the trouble is we would have to become completely extinct for that to happen. That may happen. It's really interesting in that idiot Guardian article I was compared to Robert A. Heinlein. One of Robert A. Heinlein's early novels was something called Six Column, and it's about an Asian, or basically a Chinese. They called them Pan-Asians, but basically it was a Chinese invasion of America. And it was very, very racial. This was, I think it was even before I was born, about 1950 or so he wrote this. I think it's one of the few Heinlein's novels that has not been republished repeatedly. It is extremely politically incorrect in some of its racial views. Heinlein posited that the ultimate racial conflict was going to be not between white and black, but between white and yellow. And I think our ancestors had some idea of that when they passed these anti-Chinese laws in the 1890s. And that's something we've forgotten from our own history. At one stage, there were
I don't know about millions, but there were a lot of Chinese immigrants on the West Coast. They'd been brought in to work on the railroads, and they'd established Chinatowns in just about every major city. But beginning in the mid-1890s, the government realized, hey, we really don't need these alien beings in our midst. We've got the railroads built. We don't need them anymore. And so there were massive deportations of Chinese. Now, not all of them left, but apparently it was significant enough to keep the Oriental population within bounds for several generations.
After the railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad was done, you're right, there was a surplus of the coolies. But an interesting anecdote, I took a tour of Beringer Wineries in Napa Valley, and these German brothers, they took advantage of this. They hired excess Chinese to build all these tunnels where they would store the wine. Somebody took advantage of it, two German guys. You don't know this, Harold. I was out in Seattle a few years ago, and I was up in Vancouver. Boy, I tell you, the Orientals have just invaded that area.
Well, basically what they did was they, in essence, kind of transferred Hong Kong to Vancouver. Vancouver is now Hong Kong East. When they found out that basically Hong Kong was going back to the Chinese, a lot of the Hong Kongers decided that they needed to move on to greener pastures. And what they did was they took advantage of Canada's extremely lax immigration laws for non-whites. Well, say back in the 80s and 90s, it was about as easy in Canada as it is here now. Basically, if you had a dark skin of some kind, you could just walk right in. And they transferred just hundreds of thousands of Chinese from Hong Kong to Vancouver, and they had to bring their wealth in with them somehow, so they either brought it in diamonds or in narcotics in order to avoid various currency controls and whatnot. And the result is that Vancouver is now essentially a Chinese city. And that's another little gem that we've let go. And we could take care of all this if we ever recover any kind of racial consciousness at all. But as long as we just simply sit here and take it and hand everything we've got and hand over our country to all these various non-white minorities, from their point of view, why shouldn't they just come in and take everything? We're not going to do anything about it. If we're too weak and timid and frightened and lazy to fight, why the hell shouldn't they come in and victimize us and take everything we got?
To stand up and fight this thing. But you know why I got to fight? I got to fight my own kind first. They're the ones that are going to come and get me.
Oh, yeah.
Try
That's
and kill me, throw me in prison.
Well, yeah. The Northwest War of Independence, when it comes, and it will come, is going to be just like the first war. It will be a civil war between white men due to the presence of non-whites on this continent. Just before I came here to do the show today, I was in a comrade's house, and we were watching a movie called Gods and Generals about the Civil War. And we're going to have to go through all that again. And when it comes, it's going to be largely our own white people who are the cannon fodder of the dictatorship trying to repress and destroy whatever white nationalist insurrection takes place. That's almost a given. It's the sort of thing that really makes you wonder sometimes whether or not we deserve to survive, whether a people that effing stupid deserves survival. The thing is, though, it's repairable. If we could just have a couple of generations in some place like the Pacific Northwest, free of all this cultural poison, with some kind of decent economy and reasonable amount of prosperity and advanced technology so we can keep ourselves healthy and keep one step ahead of all the people who are trying to destroy us, so if we could just raise one or two more generations in health, mental and spiritual and physical, we could do it. We could repair the whole lot. We could take it all back.
Okay, our time is up now for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.